There has been for quite some time a demand that we should concentrate on the Life Divine, the magnum opus of Sri Aurobindo, and if you want to take it up, it has to be taken up with great care and resolution. It has to be done in a very systematic manner and with a long-range idea that it is to be a program of considerable time. Should not expect it to finish. One should start it in a few lectures or talks. It is not to be studied again in a manner which would only give a superficial acquaintance. I have very often felt that Auroville should be a nursery of talents, capacities, and powers of communication, whereby works of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother could be studied in their amplitude, in their fullness, and there should be a continuous stream so that teachers, students study all these works in a cooperative, in a collaborative manner. Now the work like the Life Divine is a very difficult work. Some of the best experts in the world have come to the conclusion after reading a few chapters that the book is very difficult. Many of the people who are qualified to study it have not gone through it thoroughly. There are ideas which are incomprehensible. Even the scheme of the book is not easily seizable. On the other hand, there are a good number of scholars in the world who have studied this Life Divine quite thoroughly well, and they have proclaimed that this work is a great synthesis of the East and the West. Intellectually, it has been rated so high that hardly any other work is comparable to it. Mother herself has said in the agenda that the Life Divine and the synthesis of yoga are intellectually perfect. And this word perfect is really perfect. If you examine the Life Divine from the technical point of view, from the point of view of the arrangement of ideas, arrangement of data, physical and psychological, and the method of exposition, you can say that it is truly perfect. Those who have made a study of philosophy particularly, which involves technicalities of philosophical understanding, philosophical exposition, philosophical argumentation, they are bound to conclude that this work, by applying all canons of criticism, is perfect. Mother herself had one time said that to study the Life Divine, you require 10 years of preparation. And this will give us a measure as to what kind of time we should devote to this great work. And why should we not? 10 years is, compared to the amount of knowledge which is contained here, is a very short period. At least there should be a few people in Auroville who should take it up in that light, to be ready to study it for 10 years. And I have assurance, at least from a few of people in Auroville, that they are prepared. And that gives me a very great enthusiasm, and I feel that it is an effort worth making. So I thought that to begin this series of workshops, I have called not a workshop but a series of workshops, because this is what I intend to have. If you really want to study, it should be done in the atmosphere of a workshop, in a serious, dedicated attitude, putting into it all the work that it demands. There are some people who are reading with me Life Divine, and they are giving daily 7 to 8 hours of study, apart from 1 or 2 hours with me periodically, but they give 7 to 8 hours daily. And this is the level at which I would like, by some students at least in Auroville, to take it up. It is fact that most of you are very busy with a number of activities, and it may not be possible to give that much time, but still one can give a great deal of time. So we shall see later on, as we proceed further, as to how this program can be developed. In the first place, I would like to raise a question. What is the relevance of the study of the Life Divine in Auroville? Now, one easy answer is what I already given, that Auroville is supposed to be a place where the vision of Sri Aurobindo is attempted to be given a concrete shape. Since the Life Divine is one of the major works of Sri Aurobindo, it would naturally follow that a good knowledge of this major work is widespread in Auroville. This would be one answer to this question. But there is another question which is connected with this important point, and it arises from the fact that Life Divine is fundamentally a philosophical work. And there is, in the program of Auroville, a very important statement of the mother, that we are here to do research through experience of the Supreme Truth. This is our program. Now, this word experience is very important. The word Supreme Truth is very important. And both these terms have to be viewed against the background that fundamentally Life Divine is a philosophical work. Now, when we say it is a philosophical work, we need to understand that essentially it is an intellectual work. And many people might legitimately argue that intellectual approach does not necessarily go well with the experiential approach. Intellect is a process of abstraction. Intellectual thinking takes you to the realm of abstractions, takes you away from the concreteness, takes you to the realm of ideas and the realm of words, taking you away from substance and possession, penetration of the substance. And experience means penetration and possession. Therefore, a serious question can arise and must arise, and we should raise this question at the very outset, as to why we should undertake such an exercise which will involve an intellectual process of abstraction. Would it not hurt the basic program of Auroville, which is experiential in character? Now the answer is neither yes nor no. The first answer is that those who are already experiential, those who already developed the capacities of experience, capacities of perception of the inner truth, and who feel that they are already moving in that direction, for them this study may not be altogether necessary. I say altogether. It may be necessary even for them, but it can be dispensed with. In fact, many students of Sri Aurobindo and his yoga particularly even advocate the view that too much of intellectuality that the study of the life divine might generate is not very conducive to the field of experience of the spiritual truths. And there is a strength behind this argument which we must acknowledge. But now let us see the other side of the picture. There is a relationship between intellect and experience. Intellectual cultivation and spiritual cultivation. There is a very important statement of Sri Aurobindo where he says that while some people may be able to dispense with the intellectual approach to the truth, this approach cannot be avoided for the general collective development. Individually, some people may dispense with an intellectual development. But wherever you are dealing with the collectivity, this intellectual development, Sri Aurobindo says, is of capital importance. Not only of importance, but of capital importance. I would like to present to you two paragraphs from one of the chapters of the Life Divine, so that you may have time to reflect at home when you take up the book and see and study this issue, because this is a very important issue at the very outset. This is on page number 878. Now there are many editions of the Life Divine. So this is one edition. I think Centenary Edition has the same pagination as this particular book which I am having with me. And if you have Centenary Edition, then you look up the page number 878. And Sri Aurobindo says as follows. I will read slowly so that it can be grasped. Spiritual realization and experience, an intuitive and direct knowledge, a growth of inner consciousness, a growth of the soul, and of an intimate soul perception, soul vision, and a soul sense, are indeed the proper means of this evolution. This means spiritual evolution. But the support of the reflective and critical reason is also of great importance. If many can dispense with it because they have a vivid and direct contact with inner realities and are satisfied with experience and insight, yet in the whole movement it is indispensable. If the Supreme Truth is a spiritual reality, then the intellect of man needs to know what is the nature of that original truth and the principle of its relations to the rest of existence, to ourselves and the universe. The intellect is not capable by itself of bringing us into touch with the concrete spiritual reality, but it can help by a mental formulation of the truth of the spirit, which explains it to the mind and can be applied even in the more direct seeking. This help is of a capital importance. This is a paragraph which I would invite you to read several times, because it tells you exactly the limitation of the work that we are undertaking, at the same time its importance, and reminds us that as far as our life in Auroville is concerned, this is only a help, that we must not therefore neglect or in any case hinder or hamper the experiential approach to the true truths, to the Supreme Truths. But since, as I said, for general development, this is very important. Even for individual development, it can be of a great help. It is only from this limited point of view that I would suggest that we can have this program. Actually, I would write from the page 877 up to page number 880, these three pages, they all deal with this question. I read out only the most important portion of one of these paragraphs, from 877 to 880. Now, what is the meaning of a general collective development, and why in a general collective development This intellectual development is of fundamental importance. As Sri Aurobindo says, some individuals can dispense with it, but when it's a question of a large collectivity, a large number of them will not be capable of a direct, intuitive soul experience. A large number of people will need, even when they have some spiritual feeling, even spiritual aspiration, they will need to develop intellectual approach to the realities of the spirit. Normally, human beings, when they live in the level of the intellect, cannot even imagine what it is to have a spiritual experience. There are a number of intellectual giants in the world who do not understand what is meant by spiritual experience. This is a fact. They would even argue that spiritual experience, so-called spiritual experience, they might say, because they would not even grant the possibility of a spiritual experience, they would say that spiritual experience is only so-called spiritual experience, is an emotional reaction to whatever is presented. It's an emotional reaction. And people give a bombastic word calling it spiritual. There is a theory that not only spiritual experience, but even moral experience, which is of a lower nature, is nothing but an emotional reaction. When you say this is right and this is wrong, what is the guarantee that it is objectively right and wrong? It is simply dependent upon individual's idiosyncrasy, inclination, predilection. And one chooses and says this is right, or chooses that it is wrong. There is a very important paragraph in the one of the last chapters of the book by Bertrand Russell. It's one of the very big works called The History of Western Philosophy. And he argues, why should I advocate peace in the world? Why should people be kind? Actually, he is a great advocate of peace. There is a very beautiful passage, Free Man's Worship, where he speaks of the need of free man to have qualities which are specially those which are advocated by mystics. Quality of patience, of stoicism, endurance, disregard of consequences of action, and kindness to people, genuine compassion for all creatures of existence. All these are beautiful qualities, and he advocates them. And yet this very author, when he examines, he says, from the point of view of knowledge, there is only one way of knowing. There is only one way of knowing, and that is scientific way of knowing. He does not even regard philosophical way of knowing as a very genuine way of knowing. He grants some place to philosophy. He calls it no man's land. Philosophy, according to him, is no man's land. It doesn't belong either to science, which is definite, does not belong to religion, which is definite. Philosophy is no man's land. Is neither science nor religion, falls in between the two. Perhaps it is even worse. But such is, or may be better to some extent, depending upon how you look upon it. But such is the nature of philosophy according to him. In any case, genuine knowledge, the knowledge, what can be called knowledge, is according to him only scientific. Only science is the right means of knowledge. He therefore disregards a claim of philosophers to be capable of arriving at knowledge. There is no such thing, according to him, as philosophical knowledge. There can be speculations of philosophy. There can be hypotheses which are put forward philosophically. But philosophy, according to him, cannot make a statement, this is true. As far as the statement, this is true, is concerned, only science can say that. Now there's a great force behind this statement. I myself agree in a very large manner, but from another point of view, not from the way in which he comes to this conclusion. So there is, at the very outset, a question to understand the nature of philosophy, the nature of science, the nature of knowledge, and then to contrast all these to what we call spiritual knowledge. Now, this is an important discussion because, particularly for us who are swimming in the field of spiritual experience, we should be aware that this spiritual field has a great connection with intellectual field. And this intellectual field has within it a good deal of controversy of the nature of science, nature of philosophy, nature of knowledge, and the claims or disclaims of various kinds affect very much the spiritual world. Not spiritual pursuit, but spiritual world. There is a collectivity in a spiritual world, and collectivity consists of individuals at different levels of development, and many of them may be at the intellectual level, partly at least, or predominantly, if not wholly. And therefore, a spiritual world is greatly affected by what is happening in the intellectual field. And if you want to give a good guideline to a spiritual world, we should have robustness by which we can understand the problems which are raised by intellectual world and place ourselves in the right relationship. We must know what is the difference between scientific knowledge and philosophical knowledge. Because then we shall be able also to understand the life divine better, because life divine is a philosophical work. And therefore it has followed philosophical method. It is not a scientific book. It's not a book of science. Now in contrast to the life divine, we have another book, The Synthesis of Yoga. Now, Synthesis of Yoga has a different method. Their philosophy is also used, but the method of exposition in Synthesis of Yoga is scientific. That is because yoga is not a philosophy, yoga is science. And therefore, in the synthesis of yoga, Sri Aurobindo follows a different method of exposition. We must be able to appreciate, from a technical point of view, how Life Divine's method of exposition is philosophical, and how the exposition which is done in the synthesis of yoga follows a scientific method. It's a scientific exposition. And because there is a connection between philosophy and science in one way or the other, you will find scientific method also in the Life Divine and philosophic method also in the synthesis of yoga. But it is these are only subordinate. Why do intellectuals of today very largely believe that knowledge can be only philosophy, only scientific? And why do they believe that philosophy is not the right method of arriving at knowledge? If this statement is true, that philosophy is not a useful method, then the relevance of the Life Divine would be in question. What is the justification of writing such a great philosophical work if philosophy is basically not a very useful activity? The reason behind is this. In science, you arrive at a conclusion by basic method of observation of facts. You observe facts, and your conclusion is strictly tied to the facts. It is true that in a scientific method, you add to the observation certain other things, which are so-called permissible in a scientific pursuit, and therefore they constitute a part of scientific method. Observation is the starting point of science. Then experimentation is the second step. But experimentation is also the aim of collecting further facts which are not normally available directly without experimentation. Now, this experimentation gives you additional facts. Then there's a question of coordinating these facts with those facts. Facts by direct observation and facts by experimentation. And you coordinate them. In the process of coordinating, some intellectual process is involved. Observation is not fundamentally a process of intellection. Observation is a part of experience. When you observe, you experience the facts. When you make an experiment, it's also experience of facts, additional facts. When you coordinate, then intellection arises. It is added, as it were, for coordinating purposes. To compare one set of facts with other set of facts. In fact, if you ask the question, what is the origin of intellectual movement? It starts when you compare one sense experience with another sense experience. When two sense experiences are to be compared, this is the starting point. You start intellectual process when you compare. Now this is a special faculty of human beings. That's why it is said that rationality is a special mark of human beings, which animals of ordinary or other lower order do not possess. This possibility of comparing one sense experience with another, and then so many sense experiences with other sense experiences, and the method by which you coordinate, that is the realm of intellectuality. Comparison implies also a process of contrast. It also implies a process of analogy. And more importantly, two important processes of what is called deduction and induction. And then finally, the process of what is called implication. So you might say that entire realm of intellectual development consists of these processes: comparison, contrast, deduction, induction, analogy, and implication. Any activity in which you do these operations is intellectual in character. If it was possible for human beings to arrive at the totality of the whole world in one single experience, the whole world to be known directly by one experience, then there is no need for the intervention of intellectual operations at all. As long as I see an experience directly, I know it. The moment there is another experience, and there is a question of coordination of the two, intellectual development is involved. This is a great connection between intellectual development and experiential development. This is very important to note. If, however, you can arrive at one single experience of the totality of the whole world and all that is beyond the world, then there is nothing to compare with, no contrast, no inference, no analogy, no deduction, no induction, no implication. It is one single experience of knowledge. Now scientists, however, know that no experience is singly obtained. The scientist proceeds by ordinary levels of experience of sense observation, sense perception. And you know that sense perception is always having a limited field. It cannot have, senses are not capable of bringing the entire totality in one sweep. Such is not the nature of sense experience. It's not possible. The question is there any such possibility of having a totality of experience in one sweep? No, if not sensuous, any other? Scientists would say, let us have an example of such an experience. That is their approach. And as I told you, the distance between intellectual operation and sense experience on the one hand, and the spiritual experience is so great that most of the people who are only confined to sense experience and intellectual experience, they are not able to understand at all, not always, but very largely, they are incapable of understanding a possibility of a spiritual experience at all. Therefore, they would say there is no such thing as spiritual experience. We should confine ourselves to sense experience and intellectual operation which aims at coordinating sense experiences of various kinds. And whatever is result, whatever is the result of this is knowledge. Particularly when that knowledge expressed in language can be repeated, can be verified, and can be falsified. These are the three marks. You should be able to repeat, you should be able to verify, you should be able to falsify. In the attempt of falsification, when you cannot falsify, then you are obliged to accept it. But you should, whatever is given to you should be at least capable of being falsified. Attempt should be possible. This is what is now called scientific method, which consists of observation, experimentation, analogy, implication, deduction, induction. This is all that science consists of. And the general trend today is to maintain that there can be excursions from these strict methods of pursuit of knowledge, excursions in the form of imagination. Very largely that is the artist's privilege to go into the realm of imagination. There can be formation of hypotheses. A hypothesis is a possible explanation of facts. So there can be intellectual operation of formation of hypotheses. There can be speculations, but these are excursions. They are not strictly scientific in character. About speculations, in fact, Newton had said, hypothesis non fingo. I cannot even imagine anything like hypothesis. A possible way of explaining in which you can speculate whether this may be an explanation or that may be an explanation. In a strictly scientific, according to him, in a strictly scientific process, even hypothesis formation he does not accept. Although many scientists today accept this hypothesis formation. But you can see how in a purely strict scientific process, what is called speculation is avoided. So people may grant that there is something like a speculative process, but this speculative process is only an amusement. It does not lead you to any knowledge. It is therefore argued that anything that you arrive at by imagination, merely by hypothesis formation, or by speculation, is not strictly called knowledge. And it is argued that since philosophy goes out of the totality of the whole field of experience, and this is a speciality of intellectual process, of rationality, and particular philosophy, that philosophical reason, philosophical intellectual perception is capable of withdrawing from the total field of experience and sitting over it as it were. This is what is called the critical functioning of the intellect. A critical functioning is to go above the whole field of experience and watch the whole field of experience and claim that this process of going above field of experience is a very superior method, and by this method whatever conclusions you arrived at is of a greater significance and a greater validity, is the claim of the philosopher, as opposed to the claim of the scientist. So let us examine this aspect, because that will give us the key to the entire method of the Life Divine. Why Sri Aurobindo expounds the way in which he expounds the whole theme of the Life Divine? It is by following the philosophical method. The essentiality of the philosophical method is to take the entire field of experience and to brood over it, and then apply the canons of reasoning to judge whether such and such experience is possible or not possible. This is how philosophical thinking works. An experience is proposed, is presented, another experience is presented, a third experience is presented. A philosopher examines the claims of all these experiences in order to arrive at a judgment whether such and such experience is possible or impossible, if possible, to what extent, and by what means can you affirm the validity of this experience or that experience. This is what is called specially philosophical method. A critical understanding of experience, a critical judgment of experience, a critical overview of the realm of experience is a speciality of the philosophical method. Sri Aurobindo says, the primary function of the intellect is understanding, to understand, whether it is scientific understanding or philosophical understanding. This is a common ground. In both the processes of science and philosophy, there is a process of understanding. Understanding is to stand below understanding, to stand under, stand below an object and to look upwards and try to grasp what it is. That is understanding. The critical understanding tries to rise above the object and then to make a judgment. Sri Aurobindo has used in the synthesis of yoga also the word overstanding, that when you arrive at a spiritual experience, intuitive experience, you are able to stand above the object and grasp and possess the object as it were from above. That is a superiority of the intuitive knowledge. You do not get subjected to, you are not standing under the weight of the object, which is the fact in this process of understanding. You are not even trying to go above it, because critical understanding is an effort always to lift oneself from understanding, to rise to a higher level of judgment. It's an effort which is very limping, it's a lame effort. Although critical thinkers believe it is one of the greatest achievements, but from the higher point of view, this is a limping experience, a limping effort. You go higher above, and from when you go above, overstanding, then the object is possessed concretely, and there can be no error in it. Both in the understanding and in the process of critical understanding or judgment, there is always a possibility of an error. But when you stand above and grasp it, there is no error. That is why it is said, intuition is free from error. If it's a true intuitive knowledge, there is no error possible. That is a mark. Very often intuition is not understood properly. Even guessing something is called intuition. But that is not true. Very often you say, I guess it is so. And he says, well, I have intuition that it is so. In guessing, there is no intuition. It may be an effort at going above whatever you have understood for the moment. You are essaying possibilities. But if it is a true intuition, it is devoid of error. It is certain, sure. There is a certainty in the intuitive knowledge. That is the process of overstanding. But in this critical process, which we are now considering, which is a speciality of philosophical thinking, the true philosophical thinking is critical thinking. So long as you only observe and coordinate and deduce and induce, there is no critical thinking. It's only recording with greater sophistication. When you only record the facts as you see, it's scientific, rigorous, accurate, verifiable, repeatable, but it is not critical. A critical thinking, first of all, becomes aware of all the assumptions which are present in the observation. When I observe an object, normally I am not aware of the assumptions under which I am observing. Human beings are not so very wide awake that when they observe things, they are also aware of the context in which they are observing, the assumptions under which you are observing. I'll simply give an example. If you lock your room and go out, when nobody is present, either in the room or outside the room now, you go out and come back and you see the room intact as you had left it. You are observing, the first observation was the room in a certain position X. You go out, you come back and you see the room again in the position X. You are sure that the room was continuing to exist exactly as it was before. When you come back and when you see the room exactly as it was earlier, you assume, now I'm using the word assume, you assume that the room, or you conclude perhaps, but it's a better word is assumption, you assume that the room was exactly as it was during your absence. Now, a critical reflection would ask you the question, how do you know that the room was exactly in the same position as you left, and as it appeared when you came back? This is the critical reflection. You assume it is true that when you came back, it was exactly like that before. But are you sure that during your absence, the room did not disappear altogether? How do you know it did not? It could have. Is there any guarantee it could not? It did not. In fact, there is one whole realm of philosophical thinking, a school of philosophy which simply says, esse e percipi. What exists is only by virtue of its being perceived. All that exists is existent by virtue of being perceived. If you don't perceive it, there is no guarantee that it exists. There is one whole school of philosophy, very powerful school of philosophy. In Buddhism, for example, it's a very great school, which is called Vijnanavada. Everything that exists is only by virtue of its being perceived. If it is not perceived, if it is not seen, experienced, it doesn't exist. What is the proof? In any case, that is a critical intelligence. What is the proof that it exists when you do not perceive it? Or nobody perceives it? There are what are called solipsists in the West, who believe that you only see your perceptions. Existing, whatever you see existing is nothing but your perception, your own perceptions. There was one Western philosopher in the recent times who said, you are in a compartment in a train which moves out of the platform. On the platform, of course, there are people who see the train and who can also see the wheels on which the train is running. The moment it goes out of the platform and in the whole surrounding there is nobody now to perceive, the passengers see only the compartments. What is the guarantee the wheels are still continuing to exist? It may look absurd because we assume that it must be. Isn't it absurd to think that suddenly the wheels disappear as soon as the platform is gone? But the critical philosopher says that there is a very good ground to argue. This is called critical reflection. You simply assume that it is so. But it may not be so. Now this idea that it may not be so, it could not be so, there are reasons or you can find out arguments for it, is the activity of critical reflection. This is an extreme example I gave you of assumptions. But there are many other examples of critical reflection. There is a very great book written by a great philosopher called Kant. It is called Critic of Pure Reason. He said that at a certain stage of his life, whatever he was thinking was as if in a dogmatic slumber. He was sleeping and whatever he thought was thought in a dogmatic manner. Until the kind of reflection that I gave awakened him. He did not take lightly this kind of a critical reflection which I gave you just now. So, he began to critically reflect without assumptions as to how we think. It was as it were trying to lift above your thinking process. Actually, when you think, you are involved in thinking process. You do not even become aware that you are thinking. It is, you are in the train of thinking. To become aware that you are thinking itself is a very great effort. And then to be able to perceive the entire process of thinking, not only periodically go back and perceive, but developing in your mind a kind of a perception which can stand behind everything that is seen as process of reflection. How the whole intellect proceeds, how it reflects, how it thinks, the entire train of thinking, to be able to perceive it from outside as it were, not understanding but reflecting upon it and trying to see how the whole thinking process proceeds. That is why I use the word critic of pure reason. It's not a book on pure reason, which describes how pure reason thinks. But it reflects upon all the assumptions of thinking, questions all of them, and asks whether any conclusions can be arrived at or not. It does not say conclusions must be arrived at. Conclusions can be arrived at or not. This is the entire process. A true philosopher must have this ability to be able to go above the process of thinking, examine all the corners of thinking, examine the assumptions of thinking, assumptions of observation, assumptions of any kind, and then to reflect and to arrive at a conclusion. This is what is called the purely philosophic method. A philosopher, therefore, assumes nothing. That is the fundamental characteristic of a philosopher. A scientist assumes, a physicist assumes, matter exists. Biologist assumes that life exists. Psychologist assumes that mind exists. A philosopher asks the question, does matter exist? Can matter exist? Should matter exist? Should matter exist inevitably, necessarily? The philosopher asks the question, does life exist? Should it exist? Should it exist necessarily? And similarly, the mind, does mind exist? Can mind exist? Should the mind exist necessarily? This free inquiry, free from all dogma, free from all assumptions, this is the purity of philosophical reflection. Now, scientists believe that this is a good exercise. But you cannot arrive at any conclusion. So it's an amusement, an excursion. Your conclusions are not scientific, they are not knowledge. They are only speculations. They might even ask, they might even raise a question, whether real criticality is at all possible. They might grant that some criticality is always possible. You can question this dogma or that dogma, this assumption or that assumption. But to claim that all assumptions can be completely questioned, such a possibility, they might even doubt. But even if you say that, well, you are able to do it, you are super Kant, not only Kant but super Kant, that is possible. Even then, you cannot arrive at conclusions. It is not knowledge. Now, this method of critical reflection is thoroughly used by Sri Aurobindo in The Life Divine. It is because of that reason that we can say Life Divine is a philosophical work. It accepts no dogmas, no assumptions. Questions everything. Allows you to question everything. It's a real free inquiry. And this is done in such a perfection that you can say, technically speaking, there is no flaw in the whole of The Life Divine in regard to this spirit of free inquiry. Now, Sri Aurobindo also would argue and agree that if a critical inquiry I'm taking more time than necessary, but I'll continue just for a short time more. That critical inquiry is useful, necessary. This is what he's following actually. But there is a limitation of this critical inquiry. And this is a very important characteristic of the life divine. Even of this critical inquiry, there is a limitation. Critical inquiry certainly should question all the assumptions. And if any assumption is presented as an assumption, it should be bombarded. It should be exploded. If it is only an assumption. But Sri Aurobindo makes a distinction between assumptions which underlie sense observation and pure intellectual process of thinking on the one hand, and the realm of superior experiences, not assumptions, superior experiences. Sri Aurobindo points out that above the world of intellectual inquiry, above the world of intellectual thought, there is a realm of experiences, not sense experience. Sense experience is only limited to sense organs. Sense experiences are only experiences dependent upon the sense organs. But that there are experiences which are supersensuous. This realm cannot be understood by intellectual process, whether it is scientific or critical. Particularly when you go to realms of experiences of the kind that I spoke to you, the overstanding, experience of overstanding, when you go above the object altogether, not by a process of thinking, which is attempted in the critical process of thinking. You try to go above the object, try to seize it from above. But really you go above this whole field of abstract thought. In concrete experience, you grasp the object and know the object as it is. In which there is no possibility of error because it is directly perceived. Not thought over, not speculated over. There is no speculation about it. It is really known. As Sri Aurobindo says, there is an experience in which the knower and the known become one in the process of knowledge. When the knower and the known become one, there is no possibility of error. So there is a supersensuous experience which cannot be brought under the ken of critical reflection. Critical reasoning cannot come into the picture and say, look, I am a judge of what can be known or cannot be known in supersensuous experience, because reason has no experience of it. Reason by its very nature is reasoning, is speculative, is only abstraction. It has no hold on the experience. So how can it sit on the judgment and say, look, I can also judge what I have never experienced? It's unfit to examine. And yet, even there is a room where critical reason can also be allowed to judge the suprasensuous experience. But with the condition that critical reasoning has to be extremely humble extremely polite, courteous, has to be very, very honest. And admit at every step of his judgment, whether it is judging only on the basis of words and ideas, or is able to respect whatever is the substance of experience, which are expressed in words and ideas. A very honest, reflective power is needed. That role can be given to critical reasoning in the life divine. You find room for this kind of critical reflection, even with regard to suprasensuous experience, but on the condition which I laid down just now. Critical reflection should know what it is, namely it is ideative in character, that it does not have a direct contact with the substantiality of experience, that the only way in which it grasps any substantiality of experience is through words and ideas. Having understood this, keeping these limitations in the mind, it can compare this suprasensuous experience and that suprasensuous experience. Can even tell you whether this suprasensuous experience is expressed properly or not, whether they seem to be harmonious or not, they can be coordinated properly or not. Provided it will not be a final judgment, that simply because they cannot be coordinated by me, therefore it must be false. If critical reflection takes up this role, then that is denied. So now we come to this final conclusion regarding one of the aspects of the life divine. The life divine takes the position that scientific process of knowledge, as understood today, namely process of knowledge based upon sense experience, is not the only method of knowledge. Philosophical method is very useful to go beyond the assumptions of science. There should be, therefore, a full freedom and utility in questioning the assumptions of science. These assumptions, when questioned, should follow rigorous canons of critical thought. I have not yet spoken of the canons of critical thought, because it's a very vast subject. We shall see it when we study life divine as a whole in gradual time. You should rigorously follow the canons of critical thought and yet would not allow mere speculations coming upon you as knowledge. Philosophical speculation is not knowledge. There, Sri Aurobindo agrees with some of the modern trends where they do not accept that philosophy gives you knowledge. Sri Aurobindo agrees, philosophy does not give you knowledge. But philosophy has a great utility in going beyond the domains of the assumptions of science. Finally, that critical reflection, which ends in some kind of speculation, should be used as a ladder or a springboard to go beyond the whole realm of thought, whole realm of intellectuality, and understand, try to understand suprasensuous experiences. Try to understand what can be called the science of suprasensuous experiences. A new science, which may be similar to the sensuous experiences and science of sensuous experience, but not entirely. You should not apply the same canons in regard to scientific knowledge which are applied in the field of sensuous experience. Yoga is a science, but its own methods are not identical with the methods which are employed in the sensuous sciences. The critical reflection, the philosophical mind should be able to understand and grasp this. It may apply its critical judgment wherever it wants, so that all dogmas can be bombarded. And this utility is of capital importance. But it should not therefore take up the role of sitting upon judgments, sitting upon in judgment over the claims of suprasensuous experiences. Particularly those experiences, suprasensuous experiences of many kinds. Sri Aurobindo has spoken of the whole realm of suprasensuous experiences. And all suprasensuous experiences are not of the same category. They do not carry the same kind of validity. But whatever the validity, degrees of probability or degrees of certainty, they cannot be determined by the critical reflection. They can be determined only by experiences. Sri Aurobindo maintains that experience itself can be a judge of experience. You don't need a rational faculty to judge an experience. It is true that reason can reflect upon experiences. It is possible. But apart from reason itself judging an experience, there is another faculty within the field of experience itself, which can judge the experience without going to the critical reflection. To the extent to which critical reflection may be allowed a role in judging experiences and even suprasensuous experiences is a question of a very sober, humble process which may be allowed, but never be allowed to have preponderance of sovereignty. In one of the paragraphs of the Life Divine, this is the last line I am speaking, where he is criticizing Shankara's philosophy, and there he says that all the arguments which have so far been leveled against the philosophy of Shankara are valid from the point of view of critical intelligence. And then he says, but in the field of spiritual experience, one single experience of the spirit can undo the whole edifice of the logic derived from sense experience and reflective thought. And therefore Sri Aurobindo says that the claim of Shankara's philosophy that it is based upon experience of the immobile Brahman is decisive. If critical intellect comes and says, oh, such an experience is impossible, this is arrogance of the critical thought. How can critical thought say that immobile Brahman cannot be experienced? And Sri Aurobindo says that if that experience is the final experience, then whatever illogicality in the philosophy of Shankara, we have to admit Shankara's philosophy is final. If the experience of Shankara is the only ultimate experience,
It is only, Sri Aurobindo says, it is only because there are other suprasensuous experiences of equal validity or even of a superior validity, not judged by the critical intelligence, but judged by the suprasensuous experience itself. It is because of that reason that you have to make a room for a perception which is different from the perception that Shankara presents. Now, this is the structure of the argument. We must be able to understand the structure of the argument, how he structures. We shall go into this later on when we come to Shankara's philosophy itself. But this was only an introductory presentation, just to give a first-hand candlelight, as it were. Tomorrow we shall go into some further depth, if you so permit. All right. Thank you.